So we define the Grassmann algebra of differential forms on the manifold. And then we said it's nice to have this algebra because we can now start defining derivatives as derivations of this algebra, meaning we can define derivatives as linear maps that obey the Leibniz rule. We introduced a more refined version of this, namely we defined what derivations are in general. There are derivations of varying degree, depending on what they do with the degree of the differential form. They might leave the degree invariant, so they might map functions into functions, and one forms into one forms, two forms into two forms, or a derivation of degree k equal 1 would raise the degree of the differential form by 1. So it would map functions into one forms into two forms, etc. And then also, we defined antiderivations. And this, if you remember, was the definition of an antiderivation. An antiderivation of degree k is a linear map of differential forms into differential form, which changes the degree by k, where k has to be an integer, but not necessarily positive. And it obeys this graded Leibniz rule, where there might be a minus 1, depending on the degree of the first of the two differential forms. And then we looked at a particular differential operator, and a particular derivation, antiderivation, and that was the exterior derivation. Remember that if we define a derivation on zero forms and on a basis of one forms, then we have defined the derivation already everywhere. The reason is that any P form can be decomposed using the Leibniz rule, essentially. And so the action of our derivation on a P form can be deduced from how the derivation acts on zero and one form. So what we did was we defined the exterior derivative, D, as an antiderivation of degree k equal 1. Now you may wonder, well, that's pretty arbitrary. Why would we do that? And why would we define it in the following way? Well, today we will see some of the nice features of this particular antiderivation. So the exterior derivation was defined to act as follows. Remember, we have to define how it acts on zero forms and on one forms, and then the rest is induced through the Leibniz rule. So we said that the exterior derivative is to map zero forms into one form. So after all, it's of degree k equal 1, so it has to raise the degree of a form. And it's mapping simply the function into its differential. So we see that this notation matches the notation that we used before. And we also say how it acts on a basis of one form, namely it maps the one forms that are the gradients of the coordinate function into zero. We looked at what this looks, how that looks like in a chart. And I won't go through this in detail again. The point is that a differential form always takes this form here with some zero form times basis, a basis of the space of S form. And then we simply applied the Leibniz rule. When we calculated the exterior derivative of beta, we applied the Leibniz rule. We had to differentiate this piece, leaving that invariant, plus leaving that invariant, differentiating this. But differentiating this didn't give us anything because we had D act on D, and that gave us a zero. We proved that, in fact, D on D is always zero. So if you apply D on a differential form, any differential form, and then apply D again, you always get zero. That's automatic. It's a simple consequence of the fact that two partial derivatives commute, which is to say that this is a matrix in J and K, which is symmetric under the interchange of J and K. And this is, of course, anti-symmetric, because this is a one form, that's a one form, this is a wedge product. and the wedge product between two one-forms is antisymmetric. Remember that the wedge product is not always antisymmetric. It depends on the grade of the form. But for one-forms, it is antisymmetric. So one of the key features of the axial derivative is this. This is what justifies the name co-boundary operator for it, as you will later see. Remember that the boundary operator that we will later encounter also has this property that the boundary operator applied after the boundary operator is zero. You see, if you take a manifold, look at its boundary, then you have applied the boundary operator once. If you now look at the boundary of the boundary, you find there is none. It's the empty set. Okay? The boundary of a boundary is always vanishing as a geometric feature, whereas this is an algebraic feature. Nothing to do with boundaries and geometry at all, in principle. But as we will later see, there's a deep connection between the two. Now let us look at an example that will show again how useful that definition of the exterior derivative D is. It will unify a lot of concepts that you may know from calculus 3 or 4, or perhaps from electromagnetism. Let us look at the case where the manifold is R3, and consider a function on the manifold, which is, let's say, the electric potential. Then this is an element of lambda 0, which is the same as f of n, just space of small functions on the manifold. Then what is the differential f, the differential of f? We already calculated how we get the differential for an arbitrary function. It is, of course, a linear combination of those basis vectors, and the coefficients were those. So this is now a one form. It's a covariant vector field. It has three components here in that basis. And you may recognize those three components as the components of the gradient field for a scalar field. And it's always in electromagnetism, for example, written with the use of this Nabla operator. The electric field describes, of course, the electric force on a test charge. Now let's assume that gamma is an arbitrary one form on the manifold. So it's no longer a gradient. It's not necessary. It may be a gradient, but it doesn't have to be. So it's just an arbitrary one form. A gradient is a one form which is obtained by taking a scalar function, just a regular function, and applying D to it. Okay? A gradient is the differential of a function. And as such, of course, a covariant vector field or a one form. But gamma need not be a gradient, so it's an arbitrary element of the space of one form, of the set of one forms. We can always write it in this form here. But you see, the gamma I don't have to be the partial derivatives of some scalar function f. If they are, then it is a gradient. But in general, it doesn't have to be. So what is the exterior derivative of a one form? Well, it's a two form, of course, because our exterior derivative is a derivation of degree 1. And what exactly is it? Well, so maybe I'll just move it up so that you see it. So d gamma is the is what we obtain when we take the exterior derivative applied to that. So what we have to do is we have to apply the d on this by the Leibniz rule, leaving that the same. And then applying it to this, and then leaving that the same and applying it to that. But here we would have dd, so that term is absent. So all we have to do is we have to apply the exterior derivative to this function here. And that gives us what? The exterior derivative of this zero form is d gamma by dxj, dxj, right? This is the differential of that function, okay? Which dxi, we leave that invariant. In principle, we would have a term plus, leaving that invariant, the gamma I, and then d dxi, but d dxi is 0. Now this is summing here over all I and all j. But we can write this as the sum over I smaller than j, and having two terms in here, using the fact that this is antisymmetric. In this way, we have that only the combination dxi veg dxj occurs where the I is always smaller than the j. This sort of thing is useful, will be useful later on as well. Well, here, this is still a special case where all the indices are running only from 1 to 3. But of course, you see that this could be, so far, this could be carried through also in higher dimensions. Now, what's special in 3 dimensions is the following. There are only 3 of them that are non-zero. You see, for example, I equal j would be 0. I larger than j doesn't occur in here. So really, there are only 3 possibilities, x, dx1, dx2, dx1, dx3, and dx2, dx3. The only 3 possibilities for that. Which is to say that the gradient, sorry, not the gradient, the exterior derivative of this one form, which is a 2 form, takes this shape and is described by 3 coefficient functions. Which is nice, because it's a coincidence in 3 dimensions that we have 3 coefficient functions. Just like a vector field in 3 dimensions, which would also have 3 coefficient functions. And for a long time in physics, it was thought that those 3 coefficient functions are the coefficients of a vector in 3 dimensional space. But it's not quite true. It's not at all true, actually. We know what these things are. They're simply the coefficients, the 3 coefficients of a 2 form, right? Because what we're dealing with here is the exterior derivative of a 1 form, which is a 2 form. So these are simply the 3 coefficients of a 2 form, and in 3 dimensions, a 2 form only needs 3 coefficients. In more dimensions, there would be many more combinations like that. And therefore, the number of dimensions would not match the number of coefficients in front of a 2 form. But in 3 dimensions, it is the case. So these 3 coefficients we may call beta 1, beta 2, beta 3, and collect them as a triple like this. And it turns out that they transform similar to a vector, but not quite the same under reflection. They pick up an extra minus sign. If you look at exactly what those things are, then you find that those 3 coefficients are what is called the curl. For example, in electromagnetism, that would be the curl. So we would write the, in electromagnetism, we would write the 1 form gamma, and then we invent this Navier operator and a cross product, which is to say we take the curl of it, and then we would say that here we have a 3 component thing, we apply the curl operator on it, we get a 3 component thing. You have to keep in mind that really what's going on is that we have a 1 form, we apply the exterior derivative, and we get a 2 form. But it just so happens that this has 3 components and this has 3 independent components. And so this is also called a pseudo-vector field. Remember from electromagnetism or from calculus 3 or 4 that whenever you have a function and you take its gradient, you get a vector field whose curl is 0. Okay, so the curl of a gradient is always vanishing. We now recognize that this is simply a special case of applying the exterior derivative twice. Right? The exterior derivative on a function gives you 1 form, and then you apply the exterior derivative again, gives you 2 form. But since it's the application of the exterior derivative after the exterior derivative, this is 0. So this is simply a special case of dd equals 0. Yep?
So the fields that we usually work in physics are one-forms, because we usually take curls of them.
Well, it depends which field you work with. The electric potential is a zero form, then the electric field would be one form. But there are also physical fields that are two form, of course. And in fact, really we should look at the electromagnetic field. Really, it's organized in a two form, the electric field and the magnetic field, as we will see later. See, this is all what you would do in three dimensions, but space-time is four-dimensional. And when we then look at electromagnetism, we will see that it all fits beautifully with electric and magnetic field all in one sort of, in one kind of object. And the homogeneous and the inhomogeneous Maxwell equations will be extremely simple equations in language of differential forms. We will get to that. It's a little later in the lecture notes. Okay, so what we saw is that the fact that the curl of gradient vector fields is vanishing is simply a special case of the fact that the co-boundary operator squared is 0. And that's because if beta is, this is just in a different language, if beta is the gradient of gamma, then the exterior derivative of beta is d squared of gamma is 0. Okay. Now there are two important definitions. A differential form omega is called closed if its exterior derivative is 0. So for example, every gradient one form is closed. You apply D on it, then it's effectively the second application, you get a 0. But this is not a definition that would be confined to one form. Could be two. But also, you could check that for a 27 form. If you have a sufficiently high dimensional manifold, you can look at 27 forms and check whether you get a 0 when you apply the exterior derivative to it. Now, you may wonder, of course, I know that if the differential form omega is the exterior derivative of some other differential form, then I know that this will hold. But it's a non-trivial question. Whether if this holds, can you conclude from that that it is the, that omega is the exterior derivative of another form? So the question is, can this vanish only because omega is the d of something, or can it be that this vanishes without omega being the d of something? To discuss this question, the second definition is very useful. We say that the differential form omega is exact if there exists a differential form of which it is the d, of which it is the exterior derivative. So then the question that we just discussed is every closed differential form the d of something, which is to say, is it also exact? We know that if a differential form, well, let me check. Hello? Oh, can you try to dial in? Yes, please. Can you do that? All right, okay, so I'll tell Jacob then to try to call you. Okay, thanks. Okay, bye. Jacob, did you hear that? Guelph doesn't have your IP address or something, so they don't know how to dial in. Can you please try to dial them? And Guelph, Guelph can't hear me now. Okay. All right. Okay, so we know clearly that every exact differential form is closed. If it is the D of something, then if you apply another D to it, it's 0. But is every closed differential form exact? how are closeness and exactness related? Interestingly, the answer depends on the global topology of the manifold. It depends on whether the manifold has roughly the shape of the topology of a sphere, for example, or of a donut, whether it has a hole or several holes or handles or doesn't. Oh, that's good. Okay, so in the simplest case, let's assume that the manifold is contractible, which is to say that there is a continuous deformation parameterized by a parameter running from 0 to 1. Could somebody please close that door there? So assume that there is a continuous deformation that of the manifold into itself, such that initially this map is mapping all points onto themselves, and eventually, if once you're done with this family of deformations, all of the manifold is just mapped into a point. But for example, a flying carpet. You could do that. You could shrink it in a continuous fashion until everything is just a point in a continuous fashion. But if the flying carpet had a hole, you couldn't do it. You would get stuck somewhere. Now, here's Poincaré's lemma. He showed that on any contractible manifold, it is true that if gamma is exact, then gamma is closed, and vice versa. We know already that if it's exact, it's closed. But the point is that if it is closed, it's also exact. So for example, Rn is contractible. But if you take Rn and take a point out of it, then it is topologically just like a donut or something. Whether you take out a point or an entire disk doesn't matter. Then it's not contractible. If you take out several points, even less contractible. Which interestingly means that there will be forms that are closed without being exact. In a way, this is showing you that something interesting is happening in the notion of integrability as compared to usual calculus. In usual calculus, you know that in principle, every function, if it is sufficiently well behaved, will have an antiderivative. Okay? Even though you may not be able to write it down as a nice, well-known function, in principle, it would have an antiderivative. And this is the question we're asking here, right? Whether every differential form, or at least a subset of them, namely the closed ones, actually is the D of something, right? And what we see here is that there can be topological obstructions to this. That couldn't happen just on the line. But they can happen if your manifold has a non-trivial overall topology. So in general, we only have that if a differential form is exact. So if it is the D of something, then it is also closed, which is simply to say that D squared is zero, which is a purely algebraic property. But the reverse is not automatically true and generally doesn't hold. Now, the study of closed forms versus exact forms is one of the few handles that one has to study the global topology of differentiable manifolds. For example, to see whether or not it has holes. Of course, you can just go ahead and design a manifold that will have holes. You just give a mathematical descriptor of a donut, and you know that it has a hole, okay? But assume somebody gives you a manifold in a more obscure way. For example, it's just telling you it's a solution to such and such equation. Then what? How do you know whether the manifold that's described in this way has a hole or several holes, or whether it has handles coming out of it, and so on? So you need some methods for distinguishing manifolds. Or also, you could have manifolds that look like a Swiss cheese, okay? And you have another one that also looks like a Swiss cheese, but it's very much deformed. It's rotated against the first Swiss cheese, and it's also deformed. Now, can you tell, how can you tell whether the two Swiss cheese manifolds are the same or not, up to continuous deformation? See, it's a similar problem is somebody gives you a knot, a very complicated knot. It may not be pulled very tightly, but just a knot, very complicated. And then somebody else gives you another knot, okay? Also very complicated. Then how do you find out whether or not the two are the same? How do you determine whether you can deform without cutting or gluing, just deform the first knot so that it becomes identical to the second one? It's a very hard problem. Similarly, for differentiable manifolds, they could have very complicated structures, more complicated than knots, because you have higher, more dimensions available. So you're given one manifold and another manifold. How do you know whether they are the same up to continuous deformations, right? Because after all, we haven't fixed any metric on our manifolds. They don't have any particular shape. All manifolds that can be mapped into each other by continuous deformation have to be considered the same. So how can you check whether or not they are the same? And for that purpose, it's nice to have algebraic tools. Somebody gives you the manifold, and then you can calculate, for example, how many closed forms are there per exact form. And that you can do without even knowing how the thing looks like. And then you take your other manifold, Swiss cheese-like, and calculate how many closed forms are there for every exact form. And if in the first case you get the number 5, and in the second case you get the number 7, you know that the two manifolds have to be different. This is what cohomology theory is about. And for the purpose of studying general relativity, there is no reason to do this.
That part is not clear. You
calculate
the number of closed forms.
I'll get to that in a moment, exactly what we do there. Just a moment, please. Okay, so for the purpose of general relativity, it's not clear that cohomology is all that important because so far cosmology gets away with simply assuming that space-time is essentially topologically equivalent to R4. Sure, there are black holes and they may have holes of the manifold in the middle, but we don't really know. For the purpose of studying gauge theories, it is important. We're looking at other manifolds in this case, fiber bundles of gauge symmetries. But for the purpose of general relativity, it's not that important. So in what follows, we will mostly, nearly always concentrate on local features rather than global topology. But I thought, just for completeness, I'll tell you a little bit about it. Okay, so remember what we said about fiber bundles. I just give you an example of how you can check whether two manifolds are or are not the same. If they are looking like Swiss cheeses and you don't quite know whether the one can be deformed to be the same as the other in a continuous fashion. There's another way to determine this. To try to distinguish two manifolds, and that is called K-theory, and you may encounter that if you study either string theory or non-commutative geometry in physics applications.
So what exactly do you mean by two manifolds being the same?
Well, they are considered the same if you can continuously deform them into another. So another way of checking whether two such manifolds are the same, just like two knots are the same. In order to check that, you generally do what is called a cohomology theory. And the cohomology theory that we discussed just now, calculating the number of closed forms for every exact form, that would be called the Dirac cohomology. But there are other cohomology theories, and one of them is K-theory. And we already have the tools, in principle, to see how that might work. We
remember that for what a vector bundle is. A vector bundle is the set of all pairs of points and a vector space attached to the point. Okay, so at this point, this is a manifold here, like a donut. And at each point, we look at the point and the vector space attached to it, the point and the vector space attached to it, and so on. We require this vector bundle to be locally triggered, which is to say that there has to be a set of charts which cover the entire manifold. In our case, it's the chart U1 and the chart U2. They cover the entire manifold. You have some overlap as well. And for each chart, it is true that the fiber bundle for over just that chart is isomorphic to U1. Sorry, I'm also starting with U1. It's isomorphic. The fiber bundle, the vector bundle over just this chart, so the pre-image of the bundle projection map, is simply the Cartesian product of U1 cross Rn. In a continuous, it's diffeomorphic to that. It's not just an isomorphism, but a differentiable, invertible isomorphism. And similarly, the fiber bundle over U2 is differentiably isomorphic to that. But we can have that there's a twist, that there's a rotation between the isomorphisms of the vector spaces here and there. In which case, it is not true that the fiber bundle over the whole thing is simply diffeomorphic to m cross Rn. Now, you couldn't do that if this thing hadn't gotten a hole. Okay? If this thing didn't have a hole, then you wouldn't have a choice. You would just have this one vector bundle. So what you can do is, you can characterize, you can at least try to characterize the overall shape of a manifold by the number of vector bundles you can put on it, different vector bundles you can put on. So if you have, if you're given two manifolds and the number of vector bundles you can put on the one is different from the number of vector bundles you can put on the other, you can conclude that the two manifolds have to be different. They cannot be continuously deformed into a tuple. So now we've seen the basic ideas of two cohomology theories, closed versus exact forms. The number of closed forms versus exact forms characterizes something about the overall connectivity properties of the manifold. And so does the number of vector bundles that you can put on the manifold. Generally, there are more cohomology theories, and I'll tell you in a moment why there are several. All cohomology theories are maps, or so-called natural transformations. You have here the set of all differentiable manifolds. This set has a natural structure of category. And you have the set of all abelian groups. Also, they have the structure of a category. If you're interested in that, I can tell you a little bit more about that later on. And the point is that if you're given two manifolds here, and they are related by a diffeomorphism, so they can be continuously deformed into another, then you will have, because of the cohomology theory, that is what it is achieving, you will have a map from the group that corresponds to the first manifold to the group that corresponds to the second manifold. You will have a group homomorphism. But I should have said that a bit clearer. So what the cohomology theory does is the following. It gives you, for every manifold, an abelian group, a commutative group. Okay? So the first manifold is mapped into an abelian group. Second manifold is mapped into an abelian group. What would it be? What would this abelian group be in the case of the Dirac cohomology, for example? Well, we have closed forms and we have exact forms. A set of closed forms forms a vector space. The set of exact forms forms a vector space. If you take the closed forms modulo the exact forms, it's still a vector space. And a vector space, among other things, is a commutative group, because you can add two vectors, and there's always an inverse. So that would be, that's what the group would be. You take here the, you take the manifold and map it onto the closed versus the modulo the exact differential forms. And you can do that for every degree of the forms. And similarly here, this manifold will be mapped into the proof, which is the vector space of closed versus exact forms.
So this group will specify the number of closed forms for every exact form?
Roughly speaking, yes. Okay. Yes. You can show that this vector space has a finite dimension, so the closed versus exact forms. And that dimension is essentially what I meant by how many you have per, how many closed forms per exact form. So the point is that if you have on this side here differentiable manifolds that may be related by diffeomorphism, maybe isomorphic in a differentiable way, then their image under cohomology theory, their images are abelian groups, and they would have group homomorphisms. Therefore, in particular, therefore, if somebody gives you two manifolds in some complicated way, for example, as the solution of something, you may not be able to check whether there's a diffeomorphism between them. It's very hard to check whether there exists or doesn't exist a diffeomorphism between two manifolds. It is harder even than finding out whether one knot and another knot are related by a diffeomorphism, right? It's very hard, I mean, to check whether there exists or doesn't exist a way of deforming one knot so that it becomes the other. So that is generally a very hard problem. But if you have a simple abelian group, just a finite dimensional vector space, and need another one, then to check whether there is a group homomorphism between the two is much, much easier. So the whole point here of the cohomology theory is to say that this is hard to check whether that exists. But you can always map easily into the abelian group, for example, of closed versus exact forms. And then you check whether there's a group homomorphism between them. For example, if the vector spaces have the same dimension, they have to have this homomorphism, this group isomorphism, actually. And then you can check easily whether such a thing exists or not. If it doesn't, you know there can't be diffeomorphism, because your cohomology theory is constructed in this way, that every diffeomorphism here is mapped into a group homomorphism over there. Actually, there are two ways of doing this. This arrow might be pointing this way, and that arrow might be pointing that way. But it doesn't matter. Now, why are there many different cohomology theories? Well, the point is that none of the existing cohomology theories is perfect. You may have that there exists a group homomorphism, and yet there is no diffeomorphism over there, you see? It might be that these groups are same, and yet the manifolds are not.
Does a group homomorphism exist even though the manifolds may be different?
Yes, exactly. That is the problem. That is exactly the problem. You see, what cohomology theory does is the following. It takes a blurry image of the manifold. The manifold may be a very complicated animal, and you get just a very simplified picture of it by looking at this group that you get there. And so it might be that those simplified pictures over there agree without them agreeing in detail over there. But of course, if even the blurry pictures don't agree, then you can tell that they are different over there. Yes.
But if they existed before.
Just a second, there's somebody here.
So if you shrink like your manifold in smaller patches, cohomology would work best.
Do you mean when you look at patches of the manifold?
Like simplified, if you forget about the general complications that there may be in a manifold, if you look just at, well, locally they're just Rn.
Well, that's right. Locally they're always Rn. That's right.
The next step from locally, it would be.
Well, that's a possibility. You could say, I may have a manifold that's like a Swiss cheese, and I just take a little piece of it. It may not have all that many holes. That might be a possibility. Could be in practice quite hard. Because imagine you're giving your manifold that's a solution to some problem.
No.
Okay. Now, this is what this general idea that we want to understand something among the set of differentiable manifolds, and this is very hard. So we map this in a rough fashion, forgetting something, into some easier structure, such as this set of all abelian groups. And then if we don't have agreement there, we can conclude that there's no agreement over there. That general idea is why category theory was invented. Nowadays, it is used in many other contexts as well.
So can a diffeomorphism exist between manifolds which are different?
Well, that's the point. I mean, we're saying that that's a matter of definition. We say that they are equivalent if there is an isomorphic, if they are diffeomorphically isomorphic. So from now on, we will focus on the local properties of the manifolds. This is not to say that space-time might not have holes and whatnot, but we don't have direct evidence for that. And you know, there is the principle of Ockham's razor, who was a monk in the medieval times, who advised us to always look for the simplest solution if there are several solutions available. And according to that principle, I suppose we should postpone the discussion of non-trivial topology of space-time until we have some real evidence that forces us to do this. Physical evidence. All right, so we start lecture 6 now. Let the set, we studied, just a quick review, we go through this very quickly. We studied the Grassmann algebra of differential forms. The multiplication of the differential forms was the vector product. It's an associative algebra. It's not commutative, sometimes it's anti-commutative. The vector product is mapped in S forms and R forms through the vector multiplication into S plus R forms. So the vector product of two one forms is a two form, for example. The exterior derivative maps arbitrary forms into forms. And it is an antiderivation of degree k equal 1, so it raises the degree of a form by 1. Our plan now is the following. Remember what the overall strategy was? We had the associative Grassmann algebra, and we said, well, in general relativity, there are lots of derivatives flying around. They all will be recognized as derivations of this algebra. So we will make our way through all of those derivatives, each one being just a derivation of some kind or another. So the plan for the next derivative is the following. We define an antiderivation, Ixi. Remember that the exterior derivative was also an antiderivation. We define another antiderivation, Ixi, of degree k equal minus 1. So this thing will actually lower the degree of a differential form. The inner derivation, we call the inner derivation. So for example, you feed it a 1 form and you get out a 0 form. Feed it a 3 form, you get out a 2 form. Why would we want to do this? Well, eventually we want what is called the Lie derivative, which is the generalization of the directional derivative. We already know the directional derivatives on functions, namely simply the tangent vectors. Right? There is a directional derivative of functions. But how do you calculate the directional derivative of a 3-form? That's what we will need eventually, the Lie derivative, which is the directional derivative of arbitrary forms, and in fact of arbitrary tensors eventually. Now the Lie derivative, the directional derivative of a function is a function. The directional derivative of a one form better be a one form, and so on. So the Lie derivative, we want to be, first of all, a derivation, because it's meant to be a directional derivative which should have all the nice properties of a regular derivative. So it should be a derivation, not an antiderivation. And it should be of degree 0. Now, what we have so far is the exterior derivative, which is having degree k equal 1, plus 1, and it's an antiderivative. Maybe we need some little antidote to this. We need another derivation, namely the inner derivation, which has degree k minus 1, and is also an antiderivation. And maybe if we put the two together, then we get a derivation of degree k equals 0. That's what we would want. So the inner derivation is mostly useful to define, together with the exterior derivation, the Lie derivative. Okay, so what is this inner derivation? Surprisingly, it has nothing to do with differentiating. It has nothing to do with, you cannot write this as a Newton like its limit of something. But it's still a derivation. So assume that psi is a tangent vector field. Our aim is to define an antiderivation of degree k equal minus 1, that is a linear map which will map S forms into S minus 1 forms in such a way that it maps, we would write that it maps an S form into I psi of that S form. That's just how we would call it. I haven't defined it just yet. So the inner derivation will be written in this form, I, and then psi of omega. So the inner derivation will carry a label corresponding to a tangent vector field. We will later need that. Remember, we want to use the inner derivation together with the exterior derivation to get the lead derivative. But the lead derivative is always, it's going to be a directional derivative. So we have to label it with a direction in which we want to differentiate. The exterior derivative D has no input for choosing a direction. The inner derivation, I psi, will have that. So we define an inner derivation for every vector field. You give a vector field, and then corresponding to the vector field, you get an inner derivative. And you will say omega is mapped into inner derivation in the direction of psi of omega. It is supposed to obey the anti-Leibniz rule, as we said. So that is to say that the inner derivation of the wedge product of two differential forms is the inner derivation of the first differential form, wedge the second, plus minus 1 to the power of the degree of omega, wedge the inner derivation of nu in the direction of psi. So this is, if omega is of degree r, then this is minus 1 to the power r. Remember that if we define a derivation only on zero forms and the basis of one form, we are done. We have already defined the derivation on all of the Grassmann algebra of differential form because of the Leibniz rule. We can always use the Leibniz rule to decompose our differential forms in terms of zero forms and one forms, because every differential form is some function times dx1, veg dx2, veg dx3, and so on. So it's always a product of a zero form times lots of one form. Therefore, if we've defined how a derivation acts on zero forms and one form, we've defined how it acts on all forms. So we define now our inner derivation in the direction of psi on zero forms and one form. When on zero forms, it better gives us zero because it's to be an antiderivation of degree minus 1. There are no differential forms of degree minus 1. The action of the inner derivation in the direction psi on one form has to give us a zero form. So it maps cotangent vectors into functions. And how is it supposed to do this? Well, we define the inner derivation in the direction psi to be mapping a one-form cotangent vector field into the number or the function that we get when we apply the cotangent vector field onto the tangent field. By linearity and the anti-Leibniz rule, this already defines the inner derivation everywhere on the Grassmann algebra. Now, if gamma is an S form, then the inner derivation maps it into an S minus 1 form, because it's of degree k minus 1, k equal minus 1. And in particular, the inner derivation of gamma, well, let me just back up a moment. If gamma is an S form, then let's look at what it does at the point. An S form at the point is really a covariant tensor that is antisymmetric and of degree S, which is to say that you can feed it S tangent vectors and it will give you a number. If you look at it as a tensor field, then you can feed it S tangent vector fields, and it will give you alpha something. Now inside gamma is only an S minus one form. So this thing feeds not on S tangent vectors, but only on S minus one tangent vectors and gives you a function. And how exactly does it give you a function? Well, if these are S minus one tangent vector fields, then the inner derivation of gamma maps those, it maps those S minus one tangent vector fields into, and this is the proposition, it will map it into the number that you obtain if you take the original gamma, which has S open slots to fit in tangent vector fields, and you fill those S slots with psi, the tangent vector fields of the direction in which we differentiate in an inner way, and then fill the remaining S minus slots, S minus one slots, with the vector fields eta 1 to eta S minus 1. The claim is that this is how the inner derivation operates. And you can prove that by using how we define the inner derivation to act on zero forms and one forms, and using the Leibniz rule. Now, I won't prove the whole thing. You're invited to do it yourself. But let's just go through an example here so that you see how that operates. Consider a two-form, for example. Gamma is a two-form. Two-fold anisometric, twice covariant vector field. And let's assume that this two-form takes the following shape. It is some one-form wedge product, some other one-form. Then what is the inner derivation in the direction of the vector field psi of gamma? It's going to be a one-form, all right? But which one? Let us use the Leibniz rule for the inner derivation. The inner derivation of gamma in the direction of psi, spelled out, is this. It's going to be by the Leibniz rule, the inner derivation of omega, wedge nu, that's this, plus, we get a minus one because this is a one form, so that is one over here. Omega, we leave that in mind, and the inner derivation on nu, just the Leibniz rule here. And remember that we know what that is. We defined what the inner derivation does to one forms, namely, the inner derivation in the direction of psi of the one form omega is simply omega applied to psi. That is how we defined the action of the inner derivation on one form. Remember, we had to define how it acts on zero forms, by epsilon to zero, and we had to define how the inner derivation acts on one form. But the inner derivation I psi acts on one form omega by having omega act on psi. It's simply the mutual evaluation of a cotangent vector on a tangent vector. That's just a number if you look at the point. It's a function if you look at the manifold. So this is the thing that you get out of that. And here, similar story, you get psi on nu or nu on psi. So that's what we get here. So this is just a function. This is a tangent vector, okay? A cotangent vector here. This is a one form. And that's a one form. So overall, this whole thing is a one form. This thing can feed on a tangent vector and give you a function. And that thing, being a one form, can feed on a tangent vector field and give you a function. So since I xi gamma, this thing, is a one form, well, let's feed it a tangent vector, eta. Then what do we get? We take this thing here, and we feed it a tangent vector. So I xi gamma fed a tangent vector field. When I say tangent vector, I mean tangent vector field, generally. So we take this I xi gamma, this thing, and feed it an eta. Then what do we get? Well, this is just a number. It cannot be fed anything. But this mu is a one form. It's being fed the psi. So it's here. It's fed the eta. So we have nu of eta. This is just carried over from here to there. And here, that's just a function over here again. And this thing, the one form, is being fed the vector field over here. This is a function. Now let us compare that with the claim of the proposition. Remember what the claim of the proposition was?
the inner derivation of gamma is the following. You take gamma, which has two openings for putting in vector fields, and one of them will be occupied by the xi. Okay? That was the claim. Let's compare that. We take the inner derivation of gamma, feed it eta. Then what is that? It's the inner derivation of omega veg nu fed eta. Now, omega veg nu is, when you spell it out, omega tensor nu minus nu tensor omega. Remember, the veg product is an anti-symmetricized tensor product. And we feed this eta here. And what is that? According to the proposition, we have to put the xi into the first tensor factor and the eta in the remaining tensor factor. So we get omega of xi in the first tensor factor, and then nu is fed this, the eta, that's that, minus the reverse, and that is the same as this. So this is not the general proof, just showed it to you for an example of a two-form. Okay, so what the inner derivation does is, it's simply the inner derivation of a form in the direction of a vector field xi is simply plugging the xi vector field into the first slot of the form. And that makes it, if it started out as an S form, an S minus one form. This, of course, has nothing to do with the Newton-Leibniz limit. It's not the usual kind of derivative, but it is a derivation. And it will be very useful for expressing the so-called Lie derivative, which is a regular directional derivative. Then without proof, let me show you some of the properties of the inner derivation. If you first apply the inner derivation in the direction psi 1 and then in the direction psi 2, you get the negative as if you did it the other way around. The reason is that when you take a differential form and you feed it some tangent vector fields, you get a certain number out of this, or function. And now if you swap two of the entries, two of the vector fields, you pick up a minus sign. Because differential forms are totally anti-symmetric tensor fields, which means that if you interchange any two of their inputs, you get a minus sign. So that's just what you see here. So in particular, if you do the inner derivation in the same direction psi twice, you get zero. Because what you're doing is you're taking a differential form and you're plugging psi into the first argument and psi into the second argument. But this, since this thing is a tensor that is totally anti-symmetric, that gives you zero. Remember that this looks similar to that. And in fact, there in mathematics, theories have been developed based on this simple principle here. You see, if you have an operator that has this property that d squared is zero, then it doesn't really have to be the exterior derivative. It could be something else as well. And it may be possible to interpret this thing as a boundary or co-boundary operator nevertheless. This proof to be a rather useful concept. Well, it just came out this way, if you check it, right? I mean, this is not something we put in as a definition. It's something that we got out of it. Of course, you could also put it somewhere else in another slot, and then you just have to calculate how many permutations you need to get into the first slot, and that tells you how many minus signs you have overall. You can choose the seventh if you want, but you'll have an overall minus sign. So for xi being a tangent vector at the point P, and eta being a cotangent vector at the point P, we have in particular that the inner derivation of the cotangent vector is a one form after all, the inner derivation of the cotangent vector is simply feeding the cotangent vector being a one form, feeding it as its first argument psi. No, it has only one argument. It's a one form. So you feed it psi, which is the same as feeding gamma to psi. So the inner derivation, Ixi of gamma, of some general differential form is also called the interior product of psi and eta. It's essentially because this looks like you're calculating an interior product. It's not the same as an inner product. You have to be careful there, because the inner product requires a metric. But this is simply the evaluation of a vector and a covector, a vector and its dual, and a dual vector. And that looks like an interior product. And essentially, what the inner derivation is doing is it is generalizing that notion. If you have a one form, you can just plug in the psi, and you have an evaluation of vector against a dual vector. And what the inner derivation does is it takes an arbitrary differential form which may have many input slots, and then you feed it the psi into the first slot, which is a generalization of the interior product idea of evaluating a vector against a covector. So sometimes you find that terminology as well, interior product. But inner product is a different thing. We'll come to that. So finally, the Lie derivative. We'll do the algebraic definition of it first. There will also be a geometric definition. So the Lie derivative in the direction of psi. Remember that the exterior derivative generalizes the notion of a differential. Differentials are obtained by applying D on a function. You get a one form. And the exterior derivative generalizes that to all differential forms. So it's a generalization of the notion of gradient. Now, the inner derivation generalizes the notion of evaluation of vectors psi on covectors. And if you put the two things together, you should expect that you get a directional derivative. Because what is the gradient? The gradient intuitively is telling you in which direction things are changing most. In which direction is the function changing most? That is what the gradient is telling you. And Ixi is telling you, is allowing you to evaluate something in a particular direction. Namely, you're taking your differential form and you feed it a direction vector. Remember that all directional derivatives can be viewed as inner products of the gradient with the direction vector. So we have the two things together here. This will allow us to specify the direction. See, it has an argument psi. And that does the heavy lifting of calculating the derivative. If you put the two things together, we should get a directional derivative. Now remember that the tangent vectors psi map zero forms into zero forms, map functions into functions, and they are already the directional derivatives of functions. So the Lie derivatives better be the same thing for functions, because we don't want to have two different notions of directional derivative of functions. We already know what the directional derivative on functions is. It's simply the tangent vector's action. So how do we generalize now the notion of directional derivative from functions to arbitrary differential forms? So this gives us a strong hint that the Lie derivative, when we define it, we have to define it on zero forms and on one forms. And on zero forms, we want it to do what tangent vectors do. And in one form, we'll have to think about it. So the desired properties of the Lie derivative are, as a directional derivative, it should be a derivation, first of all, not an antiderivative. Right? Because after all, it should reduce to the usual notion of directional derivative on R2 or R3 that we are used to. And that's just a derivation, not an antiderivative. So we wanted to obey this Leibniz rule without any minus sign. Secondly, the Lie derivative, being a directional derivative, should map R forms into R forms. It should not change the degree of our differential form. After all, the directional derivative maps functions into functions. So it should also map one forms into one forms, etc. Which is to say that it is to be a directional derivative, a derivation of the Grassmann algebra of differential forms of degree k equals 0. And now we define it directly. On functions f of m, which is also lambda 0, it should be the usual directional derivative. So the directional derivative, the Lie derivative in the direction psi, acting on functions, should simply map the function into the action of the tangent vector field that defines the direction on f. Because we design tangent vector fields to do this job for functions, the directional derivative, namely this. So we've already defined the Lie derivative on 0 form. Now we still need to define it on 1 forms, and then we're done. Now consider a 1 form and of course not every 1 form is of this shape here, but we can always get a basis of gradients. I mean, this is a gradient here. Not every differential form, not every 1 form is a gradient. But we can choose over the basis of those guys. For example, we could choose this here, right? If we choose the df to be the dxi, we know that those guys form a basis. So we're not restricting generality by looking at gradient vector fields. So how then would we want the Lie derivative to act on gradient vector fields? How would we want the Lie derivative to act on such 1 forms? On closed 1 forms, really. No, exact 1 form, sorry. The exact 1 form. So here the key idea is this. The Lie derivative is supposed to be a directional derivative. The exterior derivative, we know, is also a derivative. In principle, we would like derivatives to be commuting. Whether I do first that kind of derivative and then another kind of derivative or vice versa, should, if at all possible, it will not always be possible, but if it is possible, then they should be commuting. We will soon enough get the example where they don't commute. So in this case, we can still enforce that. The idea is to define the directional derivative, that is to say the Lie derivative, of a gradient field of a function to be the gradient field of the directional derivative of the function. Okay, so with the function, we can do two things. We can take the function and apply D to it, or we can take the function and apply the Lie derivative to it. And we can do the two operations in arbitrary sequence, and we want there to be the same outcome. So we are mapping 1 forms into 1 forms in such a way that a gradient field, so this 1 form, is mapped into what we get when we take the directional derivative of f, which is a function, and then apply the exterior derivative to it, which gives us a 1 form, right? So in this way, we are mapping a 1 form into a 1 form. So what we have, so what we want is that the Lie derivative in a direction psi of this 1 form, the exterior derivative of f, is the exterior derivative of the directional derivative. Okay? So here we have the directional derivative of the exterior derivative, and here we have the exterior derivative of the directional derivative. All right? Okay, so this fixes now, this is a definition, not a proposition. This fixes how the Lie derivative acts on 1 form. Because it fixes how it acts on the basis of 1 form. Remember that this df can be chosen to be, for example, dxi, which form a basis. So now we have that lxi is a fully defined derivation because we know how it acts in 0 and 1 form. Can be related to d, to the exterior derivative and the inner derivative, to the exterior derivation and the inner derivation. And indeed we can. Here is without proof again, but I invite you to prove it's not that hard. Cartan's equation. Cartan proved that the Lie derivative in a direction psi is the so-called anti-commutator of the exterior and the inner derivative. See, if this was a minus sign, could call it the you could call it the commutator, but it's a plus sign. So if you want to calculate the Lie derivative in a direction psi, which is the direction derivative of a P form in the direction psi, then you can do it the following way. Do the exterior derivative, which raises the degree of the form by one, then do the inner derivation, which lowers the degree of the form by one, so you're back to the same degree, and then you do it the other way around and add the two. That's the same as the Lie derivative. So you see, this is an antiderivation, that's an antiderivation, but overall, this whole thing is a derivation. And while this is raising the degree of forms, that is lowering it by one unit, and so the whole thing is a derivation of degree zero. Oh, actually, I'm proving it here. Should I leave it up to you? I can't leave it up to you. It's already there. All right. Okay. Okay, it's pretty easy. Let's check that Cartan's formula is right on zero forms, and let's check that it's correct on the basis of one forms, and then we are done. So we check that it is right on one form. We apply the Lie derivative following Cartan on a function f. So we get d applied to the inner derivative of f plus ixi applied to the exterior derivative of f. Now here we have that f is a function, it's a zero form, but the inner derivative maps zero forms always onto zero. Can't map it into forms of degree minus one, after all, it has to lower the degree. So it's just zero by definition. So we're left with only this term here. But what is this? It's the inner derivation of the exterior derivation of f, which we defined to be the exterior derivation of f, You see, here this is a one form, and we feed it the psi. That's what we do, right? We take the one form and we feed it the psi. That is how the inner derivation is defined. So it's the one form being fed the tangent vector. But this is the same as psi applied to f. And that is, of course, how we defined the Lie derivative in the first place. We said that the Lie derivative of a function in the direction psi should simply be what the tangent vector does to function. It's psi applied to the function. It's the tangent vector as it stands is already the directional derivative. So the Cartan formula gives us the right thing for function. Now let's apply the Cartan formula to one form. Let's say to this df here. Then we have the d applied to the inner derivation of df plus the other way around. What is the inner derivation of, in the direction of psi, applied to the one form df? Well, this is a one form, we feed it psi. So it's a one form df being fed psi, but that is, of course, the tangent vector psi acting on the function f, of which df is the differential. And then after that, we apply d to it. And here we have d squared occurring, which is zero. So we are left with d applied to psi f, and that is, again, exactly how we defined the Lie derivative in the first place. The directional derivative of the exterior derivative of f is the exterior derivative of the directional derivative. So again, the Cartan formula gives us the right thing for zero and one form. So we've now already three derivations floating around. All of them are linear maps of differential forms into differential form. So if A is a map from the space of differential forms into the space of differential forms, and B also does that, then we can define the commutator. And we can ask, what is the commutator between all of those derivations that we have so far? What happens if we apply first D and then that, or the other way around? These things can all be worked out now. And here is what one can prove. The Lie derivative commutes with the exterior derivative. That is, should not come as a surprise, because we basically defined it in this way. However, the Lie derivative in one direction does not commute with the Lie derivative in the other direction. Whether you first differentiate in one direction and then in the other direction, or vice versa, makes a difference. You get this thing on the right-hand side there. Now you may think, wait a moment, how can that be? We have not introduced a metric, we have not introduced an affine connection. How come that there is a non-commutativity in this thing? This is just a matter of choosing your vector fields in which you differentiate in a position-dependent way. That's the only reason why we have a non-triviality here. Basically, what I'm saying, this is not a very deep thing here. If you choose for your vector fields to be simply the coordinate directions, for example, then this thing will vanish over there. We will see that in a moment. Also, the Lie derivative with the inner derivation doesn't commute. But again, it's not something very deep. To understand what's going on here, we need to understand what this is, the commutator between two vector fields. See, a vector field is mapping zero forms into zero forms. See, it's mapping a function into its directional derivative function. It's mapping functions into functions. So we can certainly apply one vector field on a function, and then apply another vector field on a function, and then do it the other way around too. So we can calculate the commutator between two vector fields. This is the thing that occurs here on the right-hand side. So we have a commutator between psi and eta of a function f. Well, we have psi applied to eta applied to f minus the other way around. What is that if we spell it out explicitly in a chart in coordinates? Well, we have here eta j, which is a function of the position in general, times the partial derivative in some direction, in the coordinate direction, applied to f. And once we are done with this, we have a function on which this is now applied. And here it goes the other way around. Keep in mind that the eta and the psi can be position dependent. So the vector field can point in any direction you like anyway. So if we collect those terms here, what do we get? We get in particular also, among those terms, we get a term of the type here of the second derivative of f. You see, there's this derivative, but then also that derivative will act on f. But here we have that as well, but with a minus sign. So the second derivative terms actually drop out of this, because we simply have psi, eta, second derivative, and here we have eta, psi, second derivative. The whole thing is symmetric, but here's a minus sign. The second derivative terms will go away. But you see, here we will have derivatives of eta. And here we will have derivatives of psi. They will be non-trivial. The derivatives of psi occur only here. The derivatives of eta only there. So that is something that is left over. So this thing becomes that. And you see now what it is. The commutator of two vector fields is a vector field. You see? Because this thing is that. You see, here you see just a basis of the tangent vector fields. Right? This is a tangent vector. It's a partial derivative in some direction. It's a tangent vector. And this is just a prefactor, which you may call mu j. So the commutator of two vector fields is really this vector field. See, this is a coefficient function. This is a basis vector in the tangent space. And so the whole thing is just a tangent vector again. So it's the action of mu on f. The commutator of two vector fields is a vector field. And now the important thing is that if the eta and the xi are position dependent, you get here some non-trivial coefficients, and you get that there is something non-trivial going on. The commutator is not zero in this case. This is because the vector fields are position dependent. Now, if, for example, you chose the vector fields to be simply d by dx1 and d by dx2, just to keep it very, very simple. So if those two vector fields are very simple, just this and that for one fixed value of I and j, so the xi and the eta are totally trivial. In this case, that goes away and the whole thing becomes commutative. So only when the vector fields are non-trivially space dependent do we have non-commutativity here. But this can be understood. You see, if you do a directional derivative in two directional derivatives, basically you're probing how the function or the tensor field behaves as you go this direction, and then as you go that direction, right? Or the other way around. But keep in mind that if you do this parallelogram, like on this way around, then at this point you have to evaluate, I mean, here you go direction psi, and here you go eta, and here you go eta and psi. But you have to evaluate, if you go this way, you evaluate psi, the vector field here, and then you evaluate eta for the next direction calculation over there. Okay? And if you go the other way around, you're evaluating eta at this point, calculate that derivation, and then you calculate, then you evaluate the value of the vector field psi at this point and go that way. And if the vector fields are different, you know, psi can have a different, the direction vector field psi can be pointing in a different direction here than over there. And therefore, you get this non-commutativity here. So it's not a property of the manifold that those things don't communicate, don't commute. It's a property entirely of the vector fields that you're using. It's very important, because later on we will get the so-called covariant derivative, whose non-commutativity will be entirely a property of the manifold. Okay, so let's ask some questions here. If the Lie derivative is a directional derivative on differential forms, which it is, we defined it in this way, then let's see, that means we know how to do directional derivatives on anti-symmetric, totally covariant tensors. But what about those covariant tensors that are not totally anti-symmetric? What about contravariant tensors? We should be able to calculate their directional derivatives as well. Can we extend the notion of directional derivative, the Lie derivative, to arbitrary tensor field? Well, for that purpose, we have to go beyond the Grassmann algebra of differential form. Let's ask whether we can do that by defining the Lie derivative as a Newton-Leibniz limit similar to the usual way of calculating derivatives in analysis. So to this end, we now study the geometric definition of the Lie derivative. I think we are out of time for today to do that, but that's what the next thing that we will do. Are there any questions in Guelph? No? Great. Any questions here? Well, is it too easy? Please give me feedback. Am I going too slow?